am not aware of the major historical events in Latvia.
Need more footnotes.
If only we could take our love of reading to a new level.
Well, I've always wanted to start a book club.
Book club!
For masochists and other deviants.
Hello and welcome to the Book Club for Masochists, where we read and discuss all the literature, regardless of our actual interest in it. So today we have me, Anna. I'm a public librarian in Vancouver, and I read a lot of everything, but not very much translated work. That'll come up.
I'm Matthew, and I do all the social medias, all of them.
I'm Megan. I'm also working in public libraries in Vancouver, and I like to describe my reading habits as those of a magpie.
I'm Jorge. I'm working in public libraries as well. I'm a guest, and I have very traditional reading habits, but I'm trying to be more adventurous.
Oh, yes, definitely. I want to hear about it. I'm totally into that. Thank you for joining us today. We're glad to have you here, because we are talking about translated literature today, thus my comment. So that was the section we read. This is another one of those instances where we are not recording immediately after we read it and had our actual month of doing this, so we may be slightly rusty on what it was we were reading, but we still have a lot of interesting memories from this and have done some additional reading from that point on.
This was one of those months, actually, where after the month ended, I just kept reading.
Yeah.
That was good.
In the middle of something, kept going. As opposed to other months, we were like, in the middle of something, stop.
Usually we started off with, what is this genre? It's so confusing. But with translated works, it was fairly simple, I think. Work that had been translated into a different language.
There was some discussion about whether it had to be translated into English. Or if people could read things that were translated from English into another language, or from, like, language Y into language Z. But nobody ever bothered doing that, so it didn't come out.
I at least checked some things out of the library.
Okay.
They were English translated into French.
So you all read books translated into English.
Yes.
Although, and that was interesting, we do have one group member who is specifically working on building up her experience of reading in English, because that is not her original language. Farsi is, she usually reads in that language, and so this is an experience for her to get the chance to do that. So that was actually a challenge for her, which was an interesting experience, because for, you know, me, I was specifically, like, just reading in my own language again. So, like, it's very interesting to have somebody in the group who is specifically choosing to challenge themselves to read outside of their own language.
And just as a note, although I don't think anybody... No, you did read a nonfiction work. So this was either fiction or nonfiction.
One of mine was fiction or nonfiction.
Was
fiction or nonfiction?
Yes.
Okay.
This could be an interesting part of the conversation. I don't remember.
Strange book.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what your background is with translated works, or just jump into what you read first?
Sure.
Does anyone have a background?
Well, I guess the background for me is that I've not thought consciously about it before. Like, I guess I should specify that. I have thought about it consciously in that it did seem worthwhile to make a conscious attempt to read more materials that come from other, more obviously from other traditions and backgrounds that come out of other languages and other uses of how language expresses what is inside of us and then pushed into my language so I can actually understand it. But I've never actually taken the time to sit down and think about the reading I do and see that that is in there somewhere or make an intentional choice. So this was the first time I made an intentional choice to say what I am reading this month is translated.
Because for me, when I was fairly young, I got my mom to buy me manga because it was translated into French, and so I could excuse it as being educational.
I was educational.
I definitely got some of those, too. I think I still have my old volumes of Dragon Ball that were in French, and it was very exciting because they weren't even in English at the time.
Yeah.
And so French was
you could
only
get them.
It was so much easier to find them in French.
And also cheaper.
Yeah.
Even buying imported ones in Quebec, it's cheaper, or at least it was, to buy the French ones than the English language ones.
That's interesting. I wonder why that was, that they translated into French.
French, bigger comic market.
Yeah, they have a way bigger comic market.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And more diverse. So it's not just superheroes. But there's a lot of stuff that's only in French that is not available in English.
Interesting.
There's also at least one instance of a manga translated into French and then translated into English.
From the French?
Yes, from the French. illegally, as it turned out. So this is Tatsumi, who's actually fairly well known, has become in the last, like, decade in North America. But back in, like, I think the late 80s, this one publisher translated one of his books that they had the rights to in Europe. Apparently they didn't have the rights for North America.
Interesting.
The background for me is very interesting because I have at least two phases when it comes to this. There was a time when I would only read it in Spanish. That's the time when I started getting interested in authors who wrote original in English. And because I couldn't read English, I read them always in translation. So that part of my life was books in translation to Spanish. And then I did the same with French. Then I started learning the languages, and I was like, I'm never going to read another book in translation from English originally. Like, never. So I started, that's how I started learning both English and French. But now in English, in this new phase, I'm reading authors that are not originally written in English or French, right? When I read in English and French. So that's how I read Haruki Murakami. First, I read him in English, not in Spanish. Yeah. And I only read one Haruki Murakami book in Spanish. The rest of them just in English. So it's like two phases I have. And for me, that was always like a thing. Like, I need to make a separation in my mind what I'm reading in the original language and what I'm not reading in the original language.
That's such a fascinating distinction that I can only read in my original language. That's the only one I've got. So, right now, maybe one day I will push my brain to do this. But that is such an interesting sort of decision point to have to make about, like, what is valuable to read and which language and why.
And then you have different reasons. You want to read. The romantic reason is you want to savor the words in the range. But then you have the practical reason. I need to practice my English. So I'm going to read in English. Just in English. And then you find that it's probably lame to read books in translation if they're in the original language. And then there is another thing that this is like a side comment. In the Spanish publishing world, there is not one world, but several worlds. So most, because the publishing capital is Spain, most books will be translated in the Spanish from Spain. And that's a horrible Spanish. Mm. So you don't want to read the books in that Spanish. So if you want to read an author that writes lots of slang, and then all the slang is suddenly from Spain, it doesn't make any sense. Mm. Why would this guy from the US be using that slang?
Right.
So if you want to read in either your language or the original language, it's only possible when you read, like, authors that have been translated.
That's definitely something I've encountered as well. I have a degree in Russian literature. Very useful. And the importance of translators is something that really comes up. And there were translators who you could tell what country they were from. Ooh. Because, you're using UK-specific slang to translate this book that's set in 19th century Russia. And it just really brought me out of it. And just like this is, nobody in Russia calls anybody else a chap. I don't think that has ever happened.
So do you have difficulty in deciding which ones? Like, does it become a real challenge to sit there and mediate out? Or does it end up being at some point or another just a practical decision?
It's usually a practical decision.
Yeah.
When you find, like, important authors, then it could be more like a deep decision. But most of the time it's just practical. Can you find it? Is it easy and accessible?
Yeah.
And I'm going to read fast. I don't know all these things.
Who wants to say what they read first?
So the first thing I read was specifically because years ago my mother had read this. It really enjoyed it and wanted me to read it. So I found a used copy in a bookstore somewhere or another at some point or another, purchased it because mom said I should read it, and never read it. And I just sat on my bookshelf, and it even moved households with me into another country, because, you know, I'm from the U.S., I'm in Canada now, and yet I still hadn't read this thing. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do some cleaning off of my own shelves. So I read The Elegance of the Hedgehog by Muriel Barbery, translated by Allison Anderson. So that was the first thing that I read, and I did enjoy it, although maybe not as much as my mother did, given her recommendation. It was interesting because it is set in it's not a hotel, it's a living condo, not a hotel, I don't know, it's an apartment like building, but it's it's like a fancy one, it's like super upscale, fancy apartment like building. Yes, okay. Exactly, because it's all based around the person who is the doorman, or in this case, a door woman. And so it's set all within that space, pretty much exclusively. You almost never step outside of that space, so you don't actually get the flavor of the city, so it is set in Paris explicitly, but you get it implicitly through a lot of the things that are going on. I think, actually, you do very briefly stuff, and I think there's one scene where you go shopping with one of the characters or something, but it's pretty much just within the walls of that building.
Is it like a weird metatextual thing where you actually go shopping with the character?
Yeah,
the
totally. That's exactly what I did. I went shopping in Paris.
Like it directly addresses you. I'd be like, come, reader, let us go to my favorite shop. Or no.
I almost wish it was, but sounds great, actually. I would love a shopping trip in Paris, thank you. Well, if it wasn't my money. yeah, so, and it was about a very precocious child character and essentially a very precocious older character. And the child is from one of the very wealthy families in there, and the older character is the door woman there. And they're living parallel lives, both having these very rich intellectual lives parallel to each other in different spheres in the same building until they cross for reasons and they start to better understand each other. And it's interesting, but it's a little too much precocious for me. Like, I was getting a little, from both characters, it was a little too much. It wasn't just the child, because, you know, the whole precocious child thing can be an issue, but both of them were a little much for me. But it was interesting, and there were a lot of references to culture, literature, etc., that I vaguely got, or knew of, but didn't actually really deeply know, so there were a number of instances where I stepped out to go Wikipedia and be like, what was that? I know that's a thing, but what was that?
That's definitely an issue sometimes in these things where something is just referenced, and it could be a like TV show or a major historical event, and you're just like, I am not aware of the major historical events in Latvia.
Need more footnotes.
More footnotes.
That's what we need.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know. I had an idea, but that's quite honestly, they're interesting.
Yeah.
So that was the only piece of fiction I ended up reading then. So, interestingly, my other two pieces for that month were both nonfiction. One was the very, very short The Rights of the Reader by Daniel Pennack. And, of course, I'm slaughtering names here, but I'm just going with it. And it's translated by Sarah Adams with illustrations by Quentin Blake, who's well known for the Roald Dahl books illustrations. Those are fun illustrations. And they were fun in The Rights of the Reader as well. They add a lot to it, quite honestly. But The Rights of the Reader is just a very brief little text meditating on reading in the modern world and what that might mean now and what kind of so-called rights we are taking away from kids in terms of turning their reading into assignments. Mm-hmm. And like, what does that take away from them? The ability to put down something they're not interested in. The ability to not have to tell you what they thought about it. Yeah, so it's actually, I enjoyed a lot his meditations on what rights should be given to the reader, like the very specific little things he pulled out. But it was also maybe not as, I would almost like to go a little more serious into that in some ways, but it was a great little, it's very short. Oh my goodness, it's really, really tiny and short. I should have read it so much faster than I did.
No judgment.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And then my last one, so those were both from the French. It was just complete accident. It's because that happened to be two things, one that was on my own shelf and one that I had borrowed from the library already at the moment that we got assigned the genre, topic, literature, piece, whatever it is. And then the other one also just happened to come in on hold during that month, and I didn't even realize that this was, like, I knew it was something in translation, but it didn't click. Click.
Yeah.
And it didn't click because it was an audiobook. So I was listening to it. So I was listening to someone read to me in English, and even though I knew this was translated, it did not click to me to count it as one of the books that I read. As a book.
She's so funny, though.
Yeah, I know, it's so obviously, like, from a different culture and background. So the book is The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up the Japanese Art of, what is it? I can't read my own handwriting. So clearly this didn't work well. Decluttering and organizing? I don't remember. Anyways. Probably you should have a little bigger notebook. I'm writing it in. It's by Marie Kondo. It was translated by Kathy Hirano and narrated by Emily Wu Zeller. So yes, I really should have picked up that this is like so obvious. Possibly the most obvious thing I read that was a piece of translation. But like the audiobook thing totally tricked my brain. I did not think of it as being in translation because of that. Like, she's even talking about my home of in Japan, we do this, and I'm totally
the
not.
Way the storage works, and the things she obsesses about. Yeah.
It was a very strange listen, in that, like, if you know me much at all, the clutter issue. Yeah.
I think you said something like Matthew might like it if you took on some of those.
Matthew might appreciate it if I was a little cleaner and less cluttered. I also just, like, I did not read it in the spirit of, like, I actually want to change anything. I was just really curious what she would have to say. So, like, it's not like it had the slightest impact on me. It was just very intriguing to hear what she had to say. But it is basically the opposite of my being. So, it was odd.
Yeah. I did the same thing more recently, so it doesn't get included in my list of things that I read. But
you listen. Did you read or listen to
it? I read it, so I didn't get tricked by the voice. But
I don't know if that's really what did it, but I truly did not pick up on the fact that translation.
I don't know. My first pick felt almost like it picked me, because I was busy reading in a library, and I picked it up, and I was like, oh, this is in translation. Reading in translation. I guess I will read this. It was called The Cyclist Conspiracy by Svetlana Basera. I murdered it, that. I'm sorry. But he's Serbian, and the translation, I think, is done by Randall A. Major. And this was a lot of fun in the beginning. It's sort of a collection of found documents telling a story about this religion / cult / conspiracy based on how the bicycle is the most perfect thing.
Because it is.
Well, yes, see, this is why I enjoyed it. It's secret brotherhood.
It showed you on multiple levels. It showed up at that moment, and it was totally on top.
Yeah, it was just totally me.
You were ready to convert.
the members, they meet in dreams. They, like, change the past from the future. It's all very bizarre, and you have some wonderfully, like, crazy speakers, because it's all, like, this is part of someone's diary, this is, like, a collection of documents of, like, someone's manifesto, stuff like that. And it ended up having, like, I wasn't sure if the misogyny in it was supposed to be making fun of, like, how women are seen as sort of less than in a lot of ancient philosophy, or was that that was just part of what it was saying? But I just found it tired me out by three quarters through, and I was like, I'm sorry. I don't like reading all that much about that. But otherwise, I mean, who doesn't like a cyclist conspiracy? The next one I read is One Day in the Life of Ivan...
Ivan.
Ivan
Denisovich.
By Alexander...
The only person who will get, like, a defender of their name.
At least somebody can say it.
Might not have even said it properly.
Yeah, but...
More properly than you at the very least.
Yes, I don't doubt that. So this was written by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And it was translated by H.T. Willits.
I should have corrected that, too. It's Willits.
Apparently this is the only English translation authorized by the original author, who I'm not going to say again.
I'm just saying with confidence, so you assume I know what I'm doing.
Thank you.
That's nice.
Yeah. So this was fairly short, but really enjoyable. It's one day in the life of a Russian citizen who's in the Gulag. So... It's kind of strange saying I enjoyed it when really it's so completely miserable. It's really brutal, you know, they don't have enough clothes to be living in Siberia in the first place and doing this work where it's basically doing as little work as possible so that you still survive for the next day. But it's very much in the moment, in the circumstances that were. So within what I've read already from sort of that time period and the Holocaust stuff, it was well written. So I enjoyed that one. The next one I read, well, actually... I was trying to finish this because I started this book for the psychological thrillers. Oh. It was The Alphabet House by Jussi Alder Olsen, but they don't tell me who translated. So this was, it started off kind of like a spy story in the beginning. There's these two British pilots who get downed over enemy borders. They survive and try to get onto, they get onto a train that's full of injured German soldiers. So they kill at least one of them and take their places, and they end up in an insane asylum. And so they're stuck there for a while until they finally escape and one of them dies. And so the next half of the book is the character who survives being older and trying to figure out, like, where his friend is and take revenge. And I got about 380 pages in and decided I was tired. There was something about the language of the story that just wasn't compelling enough for me to make it through all the way to the end, even though it had gotten to the point where, you know, somebody's trying to kill him again. And I was just like, no, I don't have to spend my time reading something I'm not enjoying. So I quit. I'm sorry.
You're never going to finish
it? Never going to finish it. I put it away. There's not enough time in the world to read all the books I actually want to read, so I have to give up on some things. This is probably the first one I haven't completed.
Yeah, I know, you are.
Shame on me!
Intense, usually. It's like all the rest of us are like cowering under the weight of what you've read, so.
Ah, well, speaking of weight of what we read, I can go into the first book I tried to read for this.
Are you done with yours?
I have a couple more, but tell us.
Of course you do. Yeah, go for it, Matt. Yeah.
Thank you, yes.
So I went right away for the big one.
Oh, yes.
War and Peace by Lev Tolstoy. And this is, like I said, I have the degree in Russian literature. Pretty much everything I read was in translation, in English, translated into English. So, like, this is something I've been meaning to read for over a decade, but this thing is, like, 1,200 pages long, and reading it is like having a job.
There is a phrase a Mexican author once wrote, a very big book, and they asked another author, did you read it? And he said, if he got a grant for writing that book, I need a grant for reading that book. That's exactly what you need for War and Peace.
The War and Peace grant. It'd be a publicly funded grant for like anybody who wants to read.
I think it took like 40 hours or something for me to get through this book, which is insane. It is very long. It is very dense. Something like 10% of it is actually in French. And not translated in English in the actual... It like was in French in the original. And they've left the French, and then they put footnotes that translate into English, so you can read those. So you can understand it. But it's still kind of, like, strange to read that. First, on the importance of translations, I actually went out and sought a specific translation of this, because it is seen as the best translation. And that is the one by Richard Piver and Larissa Volokonsky. And that's the one that's supposed to be the best, and they've translated a bunch of stuff, and sure, it's fine. I haven't read other translations of War and Peace, so I cannot directly compare it.
When, now you're like,
when are you reading to compare?
Yes.
I am unlikely to ever do that.
You sure? It's a PhD waiting for you.
I can't imagine trying to write a paper on this book.
Yeah, where like, you actually had to do like close section reading
and
go
like,
through
and
multiple
read it more
times.
Than one time. Like, yeah. Just not really.
A couple of questions first. Did you enjoy it?
Yes. However, would I ever recommend it to somebody else? Probably not.
And second, more of a technical question. That, when was that translation?
That translation is pretty recent. I think it's since 2000. So it's this century. And so one of the things about translations from Russian literature, there's this really famous to Russian literature students quotation from Joseph Brodsky about Russian translated works into English, and it is, the reason English-speaking readers can barely tell the difference between Tolstoy and Dostoevsky is that they aren't reading the prose of either one, they're reading Constance Garnett. And Constance Garnett was a 19th century translator who translated a lot of work and is somewhat infamous for doing bad job of it. And she has her defenders and her detractors. I don't think I've ever actually read anything by her, but if you find really cheap translations, hers are the ones that are in the public domain.
So a lot of people read her because they're reading the cheap or free ones, and hers is in the public domain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, War and Peace, it is about, theoretically, Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812. And by theoretically, I mean it starts years before that and ends years after that, and has a cast of, I don't even remember how many people, so many people. Also, a lot of them share the same name. I can't remember exactly what the name is, but at least three characters have the same first name. And another thing with Russian is that people have three different names. So you have your first name, you have your patronymic, which is based on your father's name, and then you have your family name. And depending on what cultural or societal interaction you're in, people will call you by a different thing. Mm-hmm. And so you'll be reading this, and I've definitely had this happen. I'm like, after several hundred pages, you're like, oh, so this guy is the same as this other person. I had no idea. And so for this, I just decided I wouldn't think about that. I was just going to go.
You just ran with
it. And I would just be like, I don't know who this character is. That's fine.
Don't slow me down.
Like, just doesn't matter. Just going to keep going. And, which was kind of interesting. It was just be like, I don't understand this plot. Let's just keep going. Let's just keep Because if I knew if I stopped, I would not finish it. Which is actually kind of untrue. I did actually stop for a bit, and I didn't finish it till the month after we were supposed to. But I did actually get through it, which was kind of awesome. So it is about a lot of different people. It's kind of a romance and about politics and about farming, probably. Tolstoy really likes putting lots of other things into his books. It is, to be totally honest, I think it's kind of a mess. It's just so absurdly sprawling. And it is also, like, very heavily researched. It's kind of interesting to think of it as a historical novel, because Tolstoy was writing this long after these events happened. And so he was doing research, and he actually wrote about how, like, oh, if anyone wants, like, references for these things that I say happened, just, like, send me a letter and I'll get them back to you. And it's like, I can't do that now, can I, though? Not that I would, like, care enough to question him, but still. So, yeah, it's... Other people seem to think it is, like, an amazing classic of world literature.
But maybe it's just old?
I think it is good. I think if you're willing to put the time into it and understand the historical and cultural context of it, it can be, you can see why it is important. But if you just want to read a book from like 19th century Russia by Tolstoy, read Anna Karenina. Yeah. It's shorter, it's still like pretty sprawling, but it is like, I remember enjoying it a lot more.
Whereas this one was like a task, you said.
There was some point where I was like 1,000 pages in. I was like, oh, is this the main character? I was like, well, he's still alive, so I guess by default he is now the main character.
Like, kind of reminds me of my experience reading The Baroque Cycle by Neil Stephenson. Mm-hmm. Just because it took me so long. About halfway through, I'd forgotten all the characters' names. It's just a different, like, perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to read something that's sprawling.
It's kind of interesting, because I do read a lot of manga. Mm. Or, like, not a lot, but I read a fair amount. And despite reading this, one of my biggest problems with it is I can never remember any of the characters' names, ever.
Because they're just not familiar enough as names for you to easily...
No, like, and I'll be like, oh, it's characters' names begin with a T. And so, like, I'll see the name, and it's just, like, pattern recognition as opposed to actually reading it.
I have that problem, too.
I feel really guilty about it, though.
Yeah, I don't.
A while ago.
I remember, like, talking to people, other people about some of these things, though, and I'd be like, oh, that guy who did that thing. And they're like, yes, that guy. Oh, my gosh. And, like, none of us actually know who the character's name is, so...
It's funny that you mentioned War and Peace, because yesterday I found this called The 15 Books with More Current Characters That You Can Keep Track Of. And, of course, it starts with Crime and Punishment and To Kill a Mockingbird and 100 Years of Solitude. And all the way down there, you get War and Peace, which is basically the champion. So in this edition, it was 1,400 pages,
yeah.
600 named characters.
Wow.
Yeah, cast I don't think hundreds. There is a way of keeping track of this. Unless you build a database.
There's literally, like, a lot of, like, it has a several page long thing at the beginning that says these are the characters. And then at the end, it also, like, gives a lot of historical context. There's, like, page after page of, this is a real person, and this is what they did. And I'm just like, I read it, but I'm like, I don't know if I care about generals in, like, the War of 1812 at all.
Weren't there, like, two epilogues or something?
There were, like, there was a lot.
I just remember you at some point me asking you.
Oh, if I was
like, you
done?
Said you were done with the story, and then I was like, aren't you done? Why are you still reading that? And you're like, I'm on the second epilogue. I'm like, what?
Because he's determined. Yeah. So a couple of other things. Great timing. There is a new BBC series about this, so you will have all the background to watch it. I'm not jealous, but good. The second one is, it is very interesting that you mentioned you were looking for this specific translation.
Mm-hmm.
There are many translations.
Yes.
Of this. I read this book many years ago in Spanish, and I can barely remember anything. So, and that was probably by translation. But I just remember one thing that Borges said. Every great book is great regardless of the translation. So Shakespeare is going to be Shakespeare, no matter how bad the translator is. Or Cervantes is always going to be Cervantes, no matter how bad the translator is.
So that's something, I read Don Quixote years ago, and it's something I really wondered about, because I realized that the translation I was reading was written in modern English. And I assume the book is written in, like, a more archaic, like, original language, and I'm just like, if it was translated into, like, 16th century English, I don't know if I would have enjoyed this book as much.
Well, there's a couple of things to say about that. Like, well, many things to say about that. First, you can agree or not with Borges, but whatever. Second, 16th century Spanish is closer to contemporary Spanish than 16th century English is to contemporary English.
Oh,
so
there
are not, like, you don't need a class in 16th century Spanish if you speak Spanish to read Quixote. So that's a great event.
It's something I've always wondered about, translations of Shakespeare into other languages, because I'm just like, there's so much stuff there that, like, people that speak English their entire lives have no idea what he's talking about.
That's the other thing, like, because there are discussions about translating books into another language, but then this is another case of, that's a completely different language, so we deserve a translation of Shakespeare to contemporary English. I would never read Shakespeare in the original language, why would I? Like, unless you are doing a PhD in contemporary English.
Or unless you're assigned it for a high school English class.
Yes.
Well, that sounds... I'm glad I grew up in the country, but... or the U.S.
Yeah. So I'm going to assume that was the only book that you read for that month?
No, I read two others.
Oh my gosh.
Whoa.
What?
Yeah, well, he only read half of War and Peace that month, right?
I was also unemployed and had two very long bus rides to Olympia.
Oh, that's right.
To and from Olympia. So that was a lot of time sitting on a bus with not a lot else to do.
Yeah. So what else?
So I read A Three-Body Problem. By, now here's the time when I don't know how to pronounce this character, this person's names or anything. Cixin Liu, which is a Chinese science fiction novel that won the Hugo Award last year, and so it got a lot of attention because of that. And I thought it was dreadful. A lot of people really like it. I have friends who've recommended it to other people, and every time I see them recommend it, I'm like, I kind of stop myself from being like, no, it's awful. But I really did not enjoy it. For those that are thinking about it, it's incredibly, incredibly important to realize it is not a complete story.
What do you mean?
It is book one of, I believe, a trilogy, and it is basically a prologue to the story.
Oh, interesting.
It's all set up.
Did they translate the other two?
The second one came out, I think, last August, and I don't believe the third one is out yet. And so if you want a complete story, you're not going to get it.
Unless you read the
book. Yeah. And I did not realize that going in. Mm. And sometimes, like, a book can stand alone, like, but this is definitely not a case of that at all.
Are you going to read the other two?
No, definitely not.
What if it becomes great after two books?
As Megan said, there are so many things I have to read. I'm not going to read the sequel to a book I hated. So, it's... The beginning, I thought, was actually really interesting. It was all about the Cultural Revolution in China. So there was all these historical aspects. And I was wondering if it was just going to be a novel about scientists in the Cultural Revolution, which would have been like, oh, that's definitely the book I want to read. And the first bit about characters dealing with the Cultural Revolution and dealing with the Chinese military was, to me, like, really interesting. And then it went to the present day. And there are many problems, A, with the science that's actually involved, which I found more like magic than actual science. And that's something that people can, like, care about or not care about. They're like, to some people, like, it's all magic, so I don't care how realistic it seems. This just seemed, like, totally ludicrous to me. I found the main character to be very uninteresting. He seemed more to kind of exist to have people tell him things.
Yeah, blank slate on which the torture. He was a stand-in for you, but you needed an actual.
I would have liked that. I also, like, I read this a couple months ago, thinking back and looking back, the thing I think I have the most problems with is I don't think there's a video game that plays a major aspect of the plot. I don't know if the writer has ever actually played a video game. They certainly do not understand what makes an appealing video game in any way.
You had no interest in that video game, huh?
So this is a video game where you have to wear, like, a full immersive VR suit, and then you end up on a planet, and you argue with people about basically math problems.
I've been looking for that one.
And I was just like... and this was apparently a very popular game. And I was like...
What?
I just couldn't really see it catching on.
There was a lot of inarticulate, like, gesticulation.
The most polite way of putting that was I don't really see it catching on as even a mildly popular video game. Yeah.
All right, what was the other one you read, then?
The final one I read was H-H-H-H by...
Oh, for those without an accent. I always tease you on this one. H-H-H-H-H-H-H-H-H. I don't know. I just love it. It's just amazing to me.
By Laurent Binet, and so translated from French. And it was about... So this is the one that was part fiction and part nonfiction. So it was about... It's described as a novel... And it's about an actual historical event that happened. and it's about these two, a Slovak and a Czech, who were recruited by the British, like, spy agencies during World War II to kill Heydrich, who was a high-ranking Nazi official and is known as the Butcher of Prague. And it's a very strange book. I, like, looking back at how I rated it, I apparently liked it a lot. I don't actually remember that much about it now. which is really, like, seems damning with my experience. I think it's definitely worth reading. It's very... Have you guys read The Princess Bride?
Yeah.
So, The Princess Bride has these bits, so there's, like, the fiction narrative, like, there's the story, and then you have the bits surrounding it, which are all about, like, oh, I cut out these chapters from the translation, and, like, it's about somebody talking about the story, as opposed to the actual story. And so a lot of this is about Binet's experiences, personal experiences, and experiences researching this book, and, like, how he found out about this. Like, also, like, insulting other people's books about the same thing. And I was just like, how much of this is true? Mm-hmm. Like, is this actual real, or are you just making all of this up just, like, to, like,
just
to mess
everything.
With the,
yeah.
to mess with the readers? Like, and so, I thought that was really interesting. It's also told in, like, I think there's several hundred chapters to this book. It's only, like, 400 pages long. So the chapters are very short, and very, like, kind of all over the place. And it's, so it's a really interesting, I think it's an interesting book, like, how it's
structured,
yeah. And so I thought it was really interesting that way.
Yeah,
I don't have much else to say about
that's
it.
Okay. I find that interesting in terms of the, like, not remembering the specifics that happened in there, and that sometimes you can give it a good rating and think of, and describe it as being a good reading experience, but not be able to get many examples of why that would be, because it really was about the experience. Like,
yeah.
when you were reading it, it was so enjoyable to do this. You can't say, like, explicitly why that was, or what this was about, or what was going on. It was just enjoyable to be there within it. Yeah. And I've had some of those before, too. And they're really hard sells, because you're like, you're really trying
no,
to tell
but it's good.
No, it's really good. I'm telling you. I don't remember what it's about, but it was good. But I don't know. It's a thing.
But
you should
Nazis,
read it.
Yeah.
You should definitely read it.
Totally sell on that.
Yeah, we have to get better at that hand sell.
So, Megan, you've got, like, three more?
Maybe. So, another one I read was written by a Quebec author. It's called Bitter Rose by Martine Delville, and it's translated by David Hommel. Sorry, I'm peering at my tiny Goodreads. I enjoyed this. This was a fairly short book. It was about 106 pages, but it was a really moody story about a young girl who moves from Montreal to a small town in Ontario. And just the families, their neighbors around her, every once in a while they'll talk about a newspaper article where a girl has gone missing. And it sort of builds up this atmosphere of, like, sort of what the environment was like to be a girl growing up in the 1970s in this small town, Ontario. And so I really enjoyed it. I actually made an attempt to get a hold of the original French copy to see if I could compare, because I found the translation kind of interesting, but the French was too hard for me to get through, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But I did enjoy it in the English, so I would recommend that for sure. And the last one it looks like I read is If on a Winter's Night a Travel.
That's what Goodreads says.
How much you relied on long.
I really love that book.
It was really good. I really enjoyed it.
So it's by Italo Calvino. This is one of the two
that Matthew actually recommended when we first started. The other one was A Day in the Life of the guy whose name I can't pronounce.
I think you should write your own version that's called that.
Maybe I should. So, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler, it starts out, you're reading, you go to a bookstore and you pick up a book and you start reading the book, and it's kind of like the style and the plot and everything change every time they pick up a new book. And so it's like this continual metamorphosis of the story and the characters and the storyline all the way through until it sort of wraps up around the end. And it was fantastic to read. It was kind of like a reader's or novel or something like that. So
just to clarify a little bit here, I want people to know that when Megan says, you go and do this, the book is actually saying you, like addressing the reader directly and saying,
yeah.
You go to the bookstore. You're looking for a book to read. How about the new Italo Calvino novel? You pick it up and decide to buy it.
This is how Matthew sold it to me. It was awesome.
It's an amazing book.
It's
an amazing
book.
Most of his books.
Oh, so I'm the only one in the room who hasn't read it yet, huh? I bought it a few years ago, but it's in storage back in Alaska, so.
So that, like, deep freeze? Yeah, it's a deep freeze.
Well, that means, yeah, yeah, that means it, like, if you preserve its freshness, then.
It's an amazing book, it is.
It was a perfect excuse to read it this month, so I was happy that came up. So that was all the books that I read,
which means it's your turn.
It's my turn. So I didn't read any books in translation this month, but I'm going to talk about three experiences I had last year. One was an accident. It's a book that I did not read, and I'm going to say why. So there is this writer. Her name is Valeria Luiselli, and she's becoming famous in the literary world. And I read about her in The Guardian, and the reviews of her books were like, amazing, it's amazing. And then I read that she was Mexican, and I said, well, I have to read this. So I saw that we have it here, and then I put on hold right away. And the book I put on hold is called Facing the Crowd. She's got a couple of other books that we also have. And I got it, and I started reading the first two pages. It's a very short book. And then I realized, she's Mexican, it's probably a translation. I didn't think about it until then.
Yeah.
And I go and check, and yes, it was translated. And I was like, why did I know about this book? So I stopped, and I'm not going to read it in English if I can read it in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing some research. Why is it so quick in English if it's not... I mean, she's not famous. She's very young. She's about like 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And she just started publishing. Mm-hmm. And the story is she lives in New York and she publishes almost simultaneously in mm-hmm. English and Spanish. But she publishes in Spanish and she gets her books translated. Mm-hmm. And is that... Mm-hmm.
That does... There are at least some writers who do their own translations.
Yes.
And that's like... is also a really interesting area. It's like, because there can be no original language version.
Exactly.
The only one that really comes to my mind is Shake Hands with the Devil by Romeo Delia, which is a very depressing book about Rwanda. But he wrote it in French and English, and they both came out at like the exact same time, I believe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's just like, there is no original of that. It's just like, languages.
There is another example that's similar, but not the same. Do you guys know José Saramago, mm-hmm. the Portuguese writer? Yes. He was Nobel Prize in Literature. He wrote his book in Portuguese, and his wife would translate them simultaneously into Spanish. So they were both published at the same time mm-hmm. in Portuguese and Spanish. And then this is just a side comment. You have the case of writers who write in one language, but their original language is different.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just finished reading one by a French author, except that she wrote the book in English.
Okay.
It seemed like such a strange decision, and then like you read her bio, like, oh, she's spent years living in whatever English-speaking country is, so I'm like, okay.
And some authors just prefer the other language.
Yeah.
This seems like an interesting exercise, just like you would choose to read in another language, you might choose to explore what is the artistic experience of writing. Mm-hmm.
But I can be doing that now, I mean, not that I write in English now, but I can think myself reading another language. Mm-hmm. If you want to master it, to write a book, you need like a really advanced level. Mm-hmm. That's the case of Nabokov. He wrote in Russian mm-hmm. until he went to America, yep. and then he wrote Lolita in English. Mm-hmm. Right? So he read in both languages.
Yeah.
Crazy. Anyway, I haven't read this book, going back to Valeria Luiselli. I haven't read the book because I haven't found it in Spanish. So I read the two first pages.
Yeah.
So that was a curious case of book translation that I didn't get to read. Mm-hmm. The other two cases are both the same in the way that they're both books written in a language that I don't read. One is Seda by Alessandro, or Silk by Alessandro Barico, and the other one is Closely Watched Trains by Bohumil Hrabal, and he writes in Czech. I read them both a while ago in Spanish.
And what language were they?
Italian and Czech.
Okay.
So I read them a while ago in Spanish, and they're really short, and I really like them. They're like, I love this book, I really love this. And then last year, I decided to go read both of them again. English to see, find out whether translation was better or worse. So the first one, Silk, is about silk trader who travels to Japan from France and then brings silk back to France in the 18th century too. But it's like a love story, not a like a cheesy love story, but it's a love story. And the way that he travels, and then of course he falls in love with a Japanese woman when, even when he's married, and then that's a problem. But it's more interesting than that, okay? It's way more interesting than that. It's more about the style in which it was written, because they are very short chapters. It's a very short book, and you read many things into the pages. Mm-hmm. Many, many things happen. So I read in Spanish, and it was okay, but I read in English, and I found it that it works better in English because it's so short and it tells so many things, and sentences in English are shortened and they're in Spanish and maybe in Italian. You know, so it works well for me. It was a very good experience to read again. And that's one of the cases when you finish it and it's so short that you can read it again. You have to double check. Twice again. Like, okay, this is a very good book. Very, like, I highly recommend it.
I remember reading the, I think it was John Green, who said that one of his books was actually better in German. He's like, yeah, the person that translated apparently like fixed all these mistakes I had in it or something. Like, I don't know exactly what the quote is.
Yeah, and I did listen to a podcast about a translator who said that the reason she got into translating fiction was because she read the Sookie Stackhouse, the True Blood books in French, and found them so much better written in French.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, the translation had improved the writing. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's interesting. So if I ever learn French, I'll try them in that one, because maybe that'll work better than attempting to read them in English.
Well, to be honest, I feel like they might just be better even if you don't understand French.
That is one of the ones I checked out that was French that had been translated from the English, but that I never got around to.
Second book is Closely Watched Trains, and that I liked it better in Spanish. But when looking for the book in English, I found a problem. Some translations are closely watched trains, and the other translations are closely observed trains. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, so we have a problem with that. If they can come to an agreement on the title, there's more things. And this book is set in Czechoslovakia, when it was still Czechoslovakia, in the Second World War, and they are train workers, especially young one, and they're trying to blow up Nazis' trains. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting story. It's not going to happen. It's great, and it's told from the point of view of the kid, so it almost sounds like a very naive story, but it's definitely not. Mm-hmm. It's really great. My experience reading in English was not good, but I have to say, I have a great memory of the book. Maybe in Spanish it's not as good. I read the book probably like 15 years ago, that's why I have such a great memory of it. It's probably not as great, but highly recommend it as well.
There's also the fact that sometimes reading a book a second time is such a different experience that it can be a lot less enjoyable.
Yeah.
Like, I recommended it if on a winter's night I traveled to a lot of people, but the second time I read it, I didn't enjoy it as much. And I think it was because I knew, like, even if I didn't remember exactly the details, I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And so, like, the surprises weren't there at the same extent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Something does change in that sometimes. I was rereading one right now that I read as a teenager and having that unfortunate experience of being like, oh yeah, this, no wonder I was a teenager when I read this.
I read an article which described the happening of rereading books that you read when you were a child and being disappointed as that childhood shelf being visited by the suck fairy. Or the fairy of misogyny. It was the fairy of racism.
Yes.
Which I think we've all had that experience.
We've all had that one.
Or even more mundane, where the fact that what you remember being in the book was just gloriously imagined scene, that when you get down to the actual page is actually just one line of text, which has nothing of what you remember in it, because what you remember was in your head.
The whole thing that you built up as you were reading it. Yeah. So I did get inspired a little bit by this genre, so after the month, I did go back and read a couple of other things intentionally, like picking some stuff that was translated, but it was slightly later. So I did read Arvida by Samuel Archibald, which is a collection of short stories, and I specifically selected that because it's a Quebecois author, and did really enjoy them. It's gotten some very good reviews and comments about it, and did really find them interesting and compelling stories. I also did start, but I actually didn't finish, The Dinner by Herman Koch, which was interesting because I was enjoying it, but it just couldn't quite pull me all the way through it. I enjoyed the experience, but I didn't quite make it all the way through. And I haven't given up on that one because it's not one where I set it down because, it's not worth reading. I'm not sure what caused me to peter out on there, and it might hold up to another try.
It's that, you know, reading mood that sort of passes through you sometimes.
I sort of suspect it was more that, like, reading mood passed through me while I was in the middle of that book, and I was just kind of like, dropped off, as opposed to, like, it actually wasn't worth my
Since
my
you started, reading. I'm going to mention one that I read after the month, because I enjoyed it, and it was so weird. It's called 70% Acrylic, 30% Wool. It's by Viola Di Grado.
I just like the title.
That's why I picked it up.
I know that is one thing I did try to keep track of for a lot of these as I was reading them, was to always know who the translator was, because I felt like that was part of the process I was doing here, was not just selecting to read in another, translated from another language, mm-hmm. but selecting to read translation is to read it through the lens of the translator too, and to recognize that there is an intermediary there, and what is their, who are they, what is their background, and whether or not I researched them, I at least wanted to continue to keep track of the fact that there was another person in there, so, you know, it's part of that process.
It's true. I read an interesting article later about translator. I think it was in the National Post, where the House of Anassi decided in 2003 to take the translator off the cover, and that got a lot of uproar within the community because the translator, like, spends months translating and is a part of the process. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they decide how much of themselves ends up in it or not, that's like a personal decision, but...
And it's even worse than that. You're not reading the original, you're reading the translator's work. Mm-hmm. That's what you're reading.
Yeah, right? It's an entirely creative process in some sense.
So yeah, I think find that a fascinating. You were mentioning that earlier, and I was like, really? What an odd decision. I just can't imagine, like, just not, like, that's such a huge process. And in some instances, and it's not, I don't think it's, you know, frequently the case, there's a relationship between the translator and the author that can be, like, span multiple books and become a real, like,
and a relationship.
Yeah, and a creative relationship between them about how this process happens. And
One of my favorite reads, that's not actually a published book, but something I found somewhere else, is the journal of the guy who translated the corrections by Jonathan Franzen. So he actually wrote a journal of that. And it's a great journal because it's both, well, it's many things at the same time. I mean, it talks about his experience translating the book, which is great. And, like, it goes in detail, like, all the different issues and problems he faces. Oh, I'm going to translate this work, I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. Then he, in many parts, he theorizes about the act of translation. Why is translation important? Why should I translate it? Like, American books, if they are already so important, blah, blah. But the most interesting part and the funniest part was the problem he had with Jonathan Franzen. Jonathan Franzen has always in his contracts a clause that says, well, I have to oversee the translations, even when he only speaks English. Anyway. So he needs to receive the chapters and review them himself. And then the translator was getting the chapters back with these corrections that he was like, this doesn't make any sense at all. So his assumption was that Franzen himself was doing the corrections on the book called The Corrections, which is weird. But he just was like, okay, I'm not going to change that. But every time he would send a chapter, he would get it back, and it was terrible. So he was like, okay, you need to find out what's happening. So he gets in touch with the agent, and the agent explains that what Franzen is doing, he gets this thing that because he doesn't speak Spanish, he's like, who speaks Spanish here? And then he goes to his building. Does anybody speak Spanish here? And then, like, the one person who works in the building, oh, I speak Spanish. I'm like, can you read this? Sure. And I'm like, what do you think? Oh, maybe you should change this. You should change that. And then he would send him back.
Why hire the translator at all? That's
when it gets back. Like, why would you take off the translator's name from the front page if he actually doing, like, not everybody can go and translate a book, right? It's a lot of freaking work. Not anybody in your building can go, like, sure, translate it for you.
Strange intervening with an expert by having random Joe up the street.
Exactly.
I've actually done some translation for, like, published works, just, like, small pieces of dialogue that were in Russian, and it's really hard.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You have to know, like, so much about the language and the culture and the context, and for, like, doing a direct translation doesn't always work, because it won't mean the same thing. So yeah, it's definitely a skill. So Megan, you were saying that about how few books were published in translation?
Yeah, so in English, so whether it's the UK or Canada or the US.
Or New Zealand or Australia or Singapore.
Yes, generally speaking, about 2-3% of what gets published is works that were translated into English from another language. And so every once in a while you'll find some articles talking about how terrible this is and what the reasons might be why. They were pretty interesting to read. I had all kinds of notes. I forgot to bring them up. Part of the problem seems to be that the English literary market is kind of dominant in terms of how much money gets into it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things that are from the American market will get published in other languages. I got some nice stats that make this seem more scary. So in comparison to the 2 to 3% mark, in Poland, 46% of books published are titles in translation. In Germany, over 12. In Spain, over 24. In France, around 15.
So is this titles or, like, the amount of stuff published in total, like copies?
I think it's just translations.
So, like, titles.
Yeah. So I wanted to get some better stats for Canada, just because we're a bilingual country, nominally, so you'd think it might be a little bit better. But we probably do have more books translated, mostly because the Canadian Council of Arts subsidizes it. So if you're a Canadian publisher using a Canadian translator of a Canadian work, you can get up to 75% or $12,000 of the cost subsidized. And that's one of the major barriers to translate it, is how expensive it is to do the translation.
I remember reading about this Canadian writer who read his entire book out in, he was also like an MP or something, in Parliament, because the Parliament, like, transcripts are translated into English or French.
They are.
And then published. And so he got a complete translation of his book done for free.
That's crazy.
And presumably he then, like, you know, fixed it up a bit, but still, it's just like, oh yeah, all our hard work is done.
This sounds like something that happened in some kind of, like, I don't know, surrealist.
To be honest, I know. So many of the stories that we've been telling about translation, like Jonathan Franzen correcting the corrections.
Yeah, okay.
Like, these all seem like things out of If on a Winter's Night a Traveler. Like.
Yeah. So we've already gone down the rabbit hole. Okay.
And so aside from the Canadian Council of the Arts, there's the Société de Développement des Entreprises Culturelles in Quebec, which does the French-English translation for Quebec works, both inside the country and for international. But I couldn't get the kind of global numbers. But in terms of what the council funded, I found that the majority were from English into French or English into other languages, because they also do Aboriginal translations as well. So let's say in 2008-2009, they funded 62 translations, 21 were French to English, and presumably the 41 were English to French. So you see the same kind of, like, imbalance between what's getting translated.
I think one of the issues is just that there is so much stuff published in English, and so it's overwhelming. It's like the amount of stuff just published in the U.S. is enough for most publishing companies to not have to deal with a translator at all.
Yeah, well, that makes sense in some circumstances. But you'd think that just with the overwhelming amount of the rest of the world against English, that there would be more translations done.
Well, you can see this from many different perspectives, right? Like, one is what you just said. Mm-hmm. But another one is we're not looking out, or we're not interested in looking what's out there. And that's not the case in other countries. They are more interested. 14% more interested. Or 16% more interested, but more interested than we as a society, I'm not talking about North American English-speaking society, is. Mm. Right? That's kind of... We were talking about that yesterday. That makes sometimes reading a little bit... I'm not going to say boring, because it's not boring, but it's not surprising. Mm. Or it's not... It's all more or the same. That's a tremendous statement, but... In a way, it's really hard to find new, exciting stuff that is really different.
Yeah.
And it's way easier when you look into translated stuff. Mm-hmm. For me, that's one of the reasons why graphics are so interesting, because you get so many translated stuff that is completely different from your own experience and expectations.
One of the things they said that was the publisher is more likely to take a chance on published works, where the small, like, indie publishers. And that might also feed into what kind of translated works that we're finding. Because either they're going to be like the blockbusters, the Stieg Larssons that get big play that we may not be necessarily super interested in because we don't follow that. And then the more interesting, more interesting to me anyway, these really weird translated works where they just come from an entirely different, like, reading culture and entirely different literary tradition.
So I guess we're getting into the appeal side of this. What is the appeal to potential readers when they're possibly selecting and asking for translator work.
So one thing that I wondered about when Megan was giving these stats was a smaller subsection of the publishing industry in comic books and graphic novels. Because I was wondering, and I don't know for sure, but I think it's higher there for the stuff that's published. Though how much higher, I don't know, and I'm just making this up. But perhaps more interestingly is the vast majority of translated works in comics that are translated in English come from only two countries. And so you have stuff coming from Japan, and you have stuff coming from France, and other than that, there is stuff from other countries that's translated, but it's definitely, like, a much, much low, like, every other country in the world is, like, substantially lower than either of those individually.
That's just a difference in what sort of gets published, though.
Well, I think it's one of the things is that those are the two countries that produce the most comics as well, but also that they are producing comics in a very different style than what is historically being produced in North America.
So they have developed their own distinct tradition around comics, and so from having that distinct tradition, we can tap into that from the English market and say, oh, look, there's this distinct tradition over here that's interesting and unique, and we can tap into that.
And so one of the reasons that this material is getting translated is because there is no equivalent in English.
Yeah.
And so if you wanted to read romance comics aimed at teenage females in English, in like America, there's not very much published at all, whereas in Japan, it's a huge industry. Mm-hmm. And so it was easier to translate this stuff and bring it over than to just like hope that you can find something.
So you may find a specific reading niche in a different tradition.
I would certainly say that's one of my strongest motivating factors for reading books in translation is the fact that I can't read all the languages, but I want to read all the books.
But I found this really interesting. It was just like, if there were no science fiction books published in English, but they were published in other languages, I would be so much more likely to just specifically search out books that were translated. Because I'm like, I can't find them in the language I can't speak. I need to go elsewhere to get these.
Yeah. Well, that's why I was reading manga books in French, because that's what they were available in.
Well, at the same time, some of the ones I was reading, you didn't really need to know how much of the language. Like, you can read Dragon Ball and be like, oh, he's punching that guy. I know what's going on.
That's certainly how we read Lucky Luke.
Two things here. Like, first, the appeal, well, that's just, for me, finding something that is really different. I just said that, but I just want to stress that. I like reading things that are different. And I'm not looking for something completely different, but it's just maybe the way, the point of view is different, the characters are different, the way they talk about it, something different too. And the other thing, and this is something that so this past November I went to the International Book Fair down in Mexico. And one of my jobs was trying to find what are the trends publishing right now in the Spanish world. And I found that the trend now is to publish graphic novels or books, comics or things like that. And I found that one of the things that the publishing houses are doing is translating books from non-graphic to graphic. Mm-hmm. So they're taking classics and they're publishing graphic. Right. So an appeal would be, because we have so many of those ones in English, is to read the same thing, but it's more interesting because it's graphic. And it's a translation. It's a translation. But also, like, many of those things are like that. Like, it makes it more interesting because you're getting something that you wouldn't find any other way, like you said.
I do think there's, for some people, there's a motivating part about the exploring. Not just the finding something as a reading experience that's so unique and different, but specifically exploring other cultural traditions. Specifically, sometimes just accidentally coming across one cultural tradition or another based on the book you select, but sometimes really seeking out a particular cultural tradition and saying, I want to read within this as a way of tapping into that a little bit.
One of the things I came across was this assumption that if a work was translated, it would necessarily be like a literary work, and so that perhaps the quality of writing would be better because it's gone through like two or three different barriers in order to get to you. Like, first it had to be published in the original country, then it had to be seen as worthwhile as translating and getting published into the English. And so you've got something that's probably better written.
That's something that's definitely seen in the comic book world, in that people are like, oh, Japan produces so many great comics. And people are like, well, they also produce a lot of trash. You know, like, you just never get the bad Gulf comics translated into English. Because there are no Gulf comics translated into English. So you don't even get the really good ones, let alone the bad ones.
There was one interesting point that actually Jorge mentioned to me yesterday, which was when a lot of a country's literature gets translated into English and you start getting an understanding of, like, what the Spanish literary tradition is, whether the English readers who come at it sort of prioritize what's most important or more important compared to what perhaps Spanish readers would identify as more important. And I thought that was an interesting point. I don't know if you had anything more to say about that.
Well, I'm going to say why we were talking about that.
Oh, okay.
Because my experience with that is my background is in literature, like literature originally written in Spanish. And I studied literature. So I, or my friends, we have our favorite authors, our favorite works of literature. And then when I came here, people would ask me, so what do you recommend? And I would start recommending stuff. And I found that the things that we think are like the best thing in the world as a group, not just myself, people here would find like, right? Mm. One example is Mario Vargas Llosa, Conversation in the Cathedral. For every young person studying literature in Spanish, well, that book is like the book. There's like nothing else like Vargas Marquez. Like it's Vargas Llosa, Conversation in the Cathedral. And every time I recommend that book here in translation, people look at it and they seriously, I didn't even finish it. It's terrible. Why would you recommend that? It's like the worst in the world. So there is two things here. Like the first one is probably it's bad translation. It could be that it is a bad translation. But then I contradict myself, like when I said earlier, Borges says Shakespeare is Shakespeare in any language. So Vargas Llosa should be Vargas Llosa in every language. Well, it's not in English, apparently. But the second thing, the second thing is that maybe it's just that we are filtering things in a way that we don't understand in the same way, even when we are translated. Mm-hmm. And I was telling you that this critic, Michiko Kakutani, in the New York Times, she created a list of the most important books by Spanish authors or Spanish-speaking authors in the world. And he picked Vargas Llosa's books, and the ones she picked was like, really? You picked that? That doesn't make any sense. But because she is an authority, suddenly those are the books that are important Vargas Llosa books. Not the other ones, but those ones, right? Yeah. So, yeah, how are we filtering stuff? I don't know. Yeah. Why it doesn't read the same? I don't know. But there is definitely a difference.
Yeah.
There.
That's a fascinating one.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about Japanese comic publishers, because now their works are translated into so many other countries and because it's become such a revenue stream for them, are actually trying to make their works more internationally appealing. Mm. And exactly how they're doing that, I don't know, but like if they are doing that, it's fascinating. It's like, we want you to write this in this way so that we can sell your book in more countries.
Rather like the movie market.
Yeah.
So take out exactly what some people are going to translated works for, which is an experience of another culture,
yep.
Taking those bits out so it's more marketable, which is part of the reason why translated works don't get as much play in the publishing world, is this self-conceived notion that they're not as marketable unless they're, you know, with a huge name.
At the same time, like, they could just be taking out things that we find horribly offensive. I don't know. It's like, stop including racist caricatures in your comics,
yeah.
Please.
Ooh,
yeah. But, yeah, I do find that very interesting in terms of cultural tastemakers outside of the country of origin making declarations about, you know, what is the greatest, like, without having that cultural tradition behind them to get into that piece. And it creates an interesting conversation because in some ways you end up with a dual piece there about, you know, this is the greatest piece from this other cultural tradition, when you bring it into translation, this becomes the greatest representative piece there because it is the best match for other traditions to tap into.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean it's the best one, but simultaneously you have the best one in the actual cultural tradition, next to each other.
There's definitely a difference between best and most representative, like most representative.
As if that was a thing.
Yeah, I know.
I've been reading like things about canon and how messed up it is that we actually have this idea of what a canon could actually be. So I find that fascinating.
There is a conversation, eh? Well, that actually made me think a little about something we said earlier with regards to literary works getting translated and like how when I was younger, my primary genre that I read in was fantasy literature. When I was a teenager, that's what I read. And I'm sure I never read a single translated thing at all within that
genre.
Mm-hmm. Because that's not what was available out there, and that's not what was big. And because there's not it's not getting translated. Like, fantasy genre are intended to be cheap.
Yeah. Harry Potter is in every language in the world.
Well, that's like the opposite, yeah. Right? English gets translated.
We have a copy of
Latin. One of our friends was very excited to get a Diary of a Wimpy Kid in Latin last year.
Yes, that created a lot of excitement.
And there's also the books that are translated into Klingon.
What?
Which is even stranger.
What?
You haven't heard about these?
Now I do.
Well, they're not in the library.
Once I was at the reference desk, yes, librarians, and a woman came to me and she specifically asked for a list of books in translation for teens. Mm-hmm. Because she had a book club with teens and she wanted to show them something else. Mm-hmm. So we found that we don't have a list, so I had to create one. And I showed her some and she was very excited. But then you remind me of this when you said, well, I used to read fancy when I was a teenager or whatever, and I never found any book in translation. But sometimes we don't even know we're in translation. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't know this author, Cornelia Funke or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you know her? Mm-hmm. I didn't know she's German, and nobody in the library knew she was German. Everybody assumed she wrote in English.
She wrote in German?
She writes German. It was the case with three or four authors. Everybody assumed they were originally in English. Mm-hmm. No.
I feel that for YA material or material aimed at younger people, or even more mass market, like, they're not going to play up that it's a translation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, when you're talking about the literary market, people are like, oh, it's a translation.
Yes.
It goes up. Yes. Whereas it's like, mm-hmm. oh, it's a terrible detective novel. Like.
That's one of the interesting things, being a reader as opposed to, like, a publisher or something like that. Whereas, as a reader, often I'm reading so much that is a translation that I'm not aware of because I don't think about it, and so, like, we have this month, and suddenly I'm thinking about it a whole lot harder. Yeah. But also, like, a regular reader, for the most part, doesn't care whether it's translated as long as the story is good, or it fits in, like, what normally appeals to them, whether it's detective stories or romance stories or whatever.
Yeah. So I have taken on a specific data sheet to track my reading this year that actually includes a column for what is the nationality of the author. It's not actually necessarily, so I'm treating it like, because I got it second, third, quadruple hand, who knows. I got it from somewhere else, and they preset the sections, and I've just chosen to go with what they had in the sections because I thought it was very intriguing to do, like, what is some version that somebody has said, and let's follow these sections and see what comes out of it when I track it that way. So I've taken it as what is the nationality of the author, because it just looks like it matched best in terms of the categories I had there to work with. And so it doesn't necessarily mean what language was it in originally, but it is making me vastly more aware of the nationality of the authors that I am reading and actually keeping track of them. Like, I go research now every time I read a book, where is this author from? Where did it come from?
What do you do when they have, like, three nationalities? Or is that only a problem I have?
Yeah. It happens, especially when they move around a lot.
Yeah, it does happen. And it is an interesting one. Like, I just read Arthur C. Clarke, who is from England, but he spent the majority of his adult life in, like, I want to say it was Laos.
Maybe Sri Lanka.
I can't remember precisely. But I spent some time looking it up and actually discovered, like, pieces of his history that I had no idea. Like, if I hadn't decided I needed to figure out what his nationality was, I never would have figured out that he was a gay man. And I could then put him also in the column that I had in there for LGBTQ author that I had no idea. So that was very interesting, like, what I am learning about the people that I read and who the authors are and where they're coming from.
I've started to use the Goodreads tags a little bit more when I have time to, which is all the time.
Yeah.
But then suddenly I'm aware of how much I don't know about the books that I'm reading.
Yeah. It changes the process. It doesn't necessarily make it better or
makes a difference.
It just does change the process.
Reminds me, I started reading Dahlgren quite a while ago without reading the foreword, because I got a little foreword to tell you about how important this book is, and I didn't care. I get about, like, three quarters through, and I'm like, this book is really weird. And I go a bit forward and read some of the actual foreword, and I'm like, oh, hippies. Oh, okay. I get it.
Got it.
Guess what?
Got it.
Thanks for listening to this club of the book club.
This club.
Thanks for clubbing this episode of the club blog for club clubs. Thanks for listening to this episode of the book club for masochists. You can find us on Tumblr at bookclub4, as in the numeral, m.tumblr.com, on Twitter at bookclub4m, on Pinterest at pinterest.com/bookclub4m, and on Goodreads, where you just have to search for book club for masochists.
On our Tumblr, you can find reviews and thoughts on books that might not have gotten discussed today, show notes that will provide links to things we mentioned, and social media info for everyone who has appeared on this episode. All opinions are our own and do not reflect our places of employment, if they exist.
We would like to give acknowledgement to the Vancouver Public Library for use of their Inspiration Lab, where we record the show. Any faults with the audio quality are representative of our own learning processes.
Come back next time when we inflict upon you the genre of cozy mysteries.
Thank goodness for editing. I might have giggled through the middle of parts of that first.
I think that's fine. It will just matter.
The audiobooking totally tricked my brain.